cell systems.
Thank you very much, and sorry for the delay. Yeah, I would like to introduce part of the work we are doing in the Morphology Group in Leipzig. And I first want to introduce my collaborators. So Yangju Wang was a postdoc for 1 year with me. She's now changed to Duke University. And Qiankang Kang also was a 1 year postdoc with me, who now changed to Vancouver. And Fritjof Lutscher is in the group of Mark Lewis in Alberta. So it's about two projects, mainly what I'm going to talk about. So we see, of course, structure formation in many cellular systems, and there are lots of examples, and I give maybe some strange ones. The classical ones are the slime mold amoeba. We have heard about that already here during this weeks, and another is the bacterium Myxococcus xanthus. And both do self-organization under starvation, but you have, of course, many more examples in bacterial and cellular life. And I give two other examples to explain what the philosophy is in the group, and we don't do modeling of that so far, but I'll try to explain the philosophy at these two next examples. And these are the exocrine glands, where the shape and the size correlate to the secretory product, and epithelia, which are interfaces, and their structure depends very much on the inside, what is inside and what is outside. So the questions we are posing is basically, can we decide from certain structures we see, and when we see changes in structures, when there are mutations for a specific species, or there is another function, can we somehow judge what the functional mechanisms are, or can we get some insight? Of course, to be honest, we cannot judge so far, but that's the aim, I would say, from modeling in biology, to check back from the structure formation on the functions, which are the basic functions and the basic mechanisms which play a role, and try to reduce what is the basic principle, if possible, of course. There are lots of other things involved, like evolution, so you never know if there's a basic principle functional change in your system, also in mutations, or if it's just a slight variation of what you have seen before in a wild type, like in the bacteria and amoeba, or if you have seen something like here, the epithelia, are they still pretty much the same with a different function, or are there really basic differences? And that's what we try to figure out. So let's just give me two of these examples. We don't do modeling of that, but to explain this kind of idea. So if you look at the epithelia, if you have type A, for instance, which is a very flat one, you see that very much in lungs. The type B, where the cells are much thicker, you see in the crystalline lens, which is good for separation. And in C type, you see in the gastrointestinal tract, where there's lots of secretion, which is the important function of that part. D is a typical epithelium in the nose, and E in the mouth, where you need a lot of mechanical protection. We don't do modeling of that, but what the question is there a basic structure of epithelium which then maybe adapts or gives rise to a certain change due to its functional principles? Or, I mean, of course, it's development, and it might happen during it will happen during your development, but how does it come about? Is there something which you can compare, or is there really something, are there basic differences?
The units of cells?
Sorry?
The units that we see are cells.
These are cells, yeah, and that's the cell kernel, the black one. Right, yeah. But these are right now just examples. And the second examples, and then I go back to what we're really doing. The second example are the exocrine glands. And you see, again, different types. I've stolen that from books, training books for biologists. For instance, the type A and D, you see typically when you have a small amount of an inviscid secretory product. B type, which is much longer, you see when you have larger amounts of secretory products. For instance, typical shape is the exocrine glands for sweat, the type B. C, for instance, if you have kind of bifurcations, let me call that like this, then you have especially viscous secretory products. F is the sebaceous gland, and G and H, they have to modify large amounts of secretory product, like saliva. Okay, now I go back to the simple systems and leave the other things for the future. So we want to look at some examples where we try to figure out the mechanism, if possible, and we look at the behavior of cellular systems like the Dictyostelium or the Myxobacteria. And here the influence is an interplay between inter and intercellular signaling, cell growth and death, cell adhesion to the cellular matrix, for instance, to other cells, motion, which is related to the restructuring of the cytoskeleton, for instance, and okay, cell movement is what we are looking for. And there are lots of things to do, and we look at the moment at cell motion, and the other things are still open to discuss. So why are we, so we look at dictyostelium, we have seen that, we look at bacteria, and it's very important to look at the same time at mutants. That's the kind of experiment you can do as a biologist, so you don't look only at the wild type, but you want to do parameter changes. And parameter changes, let me call it like the engineering type of approach, you can do, you might be able to do with the production of certain mutants. And if you can compare them to the wild type, you often see structural differences in the population. If this is the case, it's not always the case, but if this is the case, if you have a very specific structure formation in the wild type and you have a very specific change of structure in the population of the mutant, then you can use this information to get in hold of what are the structural differences and the difference patterns and what is the relation due to functional differences. Yeah, for instance, if you look at the bacteria population or dictyostelium populations, you see certain differences in motion, you see a different streaming, you see a different type of aggregates, you see less or more cells in aggregates, you see or don't see spiral formation, and so you have structural differences with mutants or different patterns, and these are very much due in that case to the signaling system, for instance, or the growth behavior, if you consider tumors, for instance. I think Philip will talk about that tomorrow. If cells grow in a different way, you also see different shapes on your, let's say, epithelia, if you have a tumor there, for instance. And you see also differences in cellular motion, especially in this bacteria and in dictyostelium, if you have mutants. And how can you reveal the functioning of the cellular system from the observed structural information? That's the kind of goal, and that's where modeling, I think, plays a huge role.
Yeah. The way growth affects the signaling system as well as signaling system affects the way growth.
Of course, yeah. That's whatever I say, this is, it's very complicated. And because you have these strong nonlinear relationships, that's why you probably should model. I mean, if you consider, maybe let me call that a bioengineer, what you can do is you change parameters, and a few of them in a linear way, and try to guess the nonlinear relationship. I mean, that's like in engineering. Either you do a black box approach, that you use a kind of linear model where you say, I do an approximation, you can do a data fitting, for instance, or you really say, I want to detect the class of nonlinear mechanism which can be responsible for that function and those which can't. I mean, with the reduced model, of course. I mean, I want to be very careful with that. I don't claim that we can solve that all. So let's have a look at the case study, and I'm looking now purely at cell signaling and coordinated movement. That means we leave out things like cellular matrix interaction, adhesion, and stuff which has to be included, of course, into a growing cell system or moving cell system. And the examples I will discuss, and the most important one is the cell interaction due to surface bound signal, which is the bacterium Myxococcus xanthus. There's a difference to this chemotactic effect in dictyostelium. And then we look again at dictyostelium, but only for a specific type of models, where cell interaction happens due to chemotaxis. Both species self-organize, and the question is, doesn't it matter what you do, or is some way more efficient? Or how can you self-organize without chemotaxis, and what do you have to do, basically? Okay, we have that. As I said, both populations show structure formation in a very specific type. I will show little films after that, and they self-organize under starvation conditions. And the mutants, defect in the signaling system, show very different patterns during the developmental process. And with Myxococcus xanthus, I have contact here with Dale Kaiser from Stanford University, who produces certain mutants and looks at the structural differences and tries to figure out if the self-organization process can really be due to surface-bound signals and can be done without chemotaxis, for instance. Okay, I said that several times, so the questions are, how does structure relate to function? How does structure relate to a specific malfunctioning? Yeah, because that helps you to understand what's going on. And you want to be able to make predictions, and you want to be able to control the system in the ideal case. but that's a far and long way to go. So what will we see during the talk? First, I could talk about the myxobacteria, so about the self-organization due to local interaction and difference to the behavior of Dictyostelium. Then I shortly introduce the classical Keller-Siegel model for chemotaxis, which is around since the 70s. And this I will relate to kinetic models for chemosensitive movement, where you really have measurable parameters like reorientation, inner chemical gradient, velocity, and these things, and tell you how they relate to this classical Keller-Siegel model. And then we exactly see what we were discussing during, or you were suggesting during one talk, that namely the diffusion and the chemotactic sensitivity in this classical model relate very much to each other, depending how this reorientation takes place. So they are not completely independent. And this kinetic model is good for translating the microscopic parameters or the measurable parameters into the macroscopic model. And then you see also changes of the macroscopic model, and we have still to analyze that, but explain what we found out. So it depends very much what type of Keller-Siegel models you have to write down, depending on if your cell measures basically along its path, or if it sort of twiddles and measures everything around itself, if it measures gradients or time gradients or space gradients, or if it measures everything. You get different models you have to use to describe that. Okay, so here should be, okay. Here it's black, but you see it. So here is Myxobacteria in the upper left. Film shows the self-aggregation process. The white one is very high cell densities, so you don't see single cells. You see these aggregates which will form fruiting bodies. This is not decidable. It's the same like in Dictyostelium, but the pre-pattern process is very different. So you have here four aggregates. This is a very high cell density. This is lower cell density. It's not an optimal film, but if you, so it's restarting all the time. If you look later close to the aggregates, you will see some kind of patterns which are close to these ones, and I'll explain that in a minute. So here you might see them, or here.
But on both sides, these are aggregates of many cells.
Yeah, these are hundreds of thousands of cells, yeah. That's the same like in Dictyostelium, but the pre, I mean, here you see a clearly pattern which is called ripples, and this is a closer view to it. So you have the same process, you have different free patterns. These bacteria are elongated, which is very much different to Dictyostelium. The way of motion is, it's not with pseudopods, it's done now by George Oster, so they try to analyze how they really do it. It's not completely clear so far. And you see different structures, so these are also elong, first very elongated aggregates. And the pattern which occurs here is this kind of rippling pattern. And what you see is, you see high cell densities, which, so periodically distributed high cell densities, which move in this direction, and others which move in that direction. These may not at all be important for the developmental process. It might be a complete lab effect. So the clearer the system is, so the agar you use and everything, the longer these patterns stay. They stay for a long time before aggregation, but they are very peculiar. So if you produce certain mutants, these patterns change. So you increase wavelength and all this kind of thing. So that means, even though that's not clear, they might not be important for aggregation. You can produce mutants, or Dirk Kaiser and others do, which don't show these patterns and still aggregate. So they might not be important for the whole reason to aggregate, for the whole process, but they are there. And since they show a very peculiar structural change with certain mutation, these might be the patterns you should look for to detect what the mechanism of communication between the cell is, because you can tune exactly this wavelength parameter. I'm not sure if you see that the movie is not very good, because it couldn't really be enlarged. So you should see periodic patterns. Maybe you look at the black ones now, which move in that direction. This is along the diagonal, and in the other direction. And these you can basically tune with mutants. So there was an idea around which Dirk Kaiser asked modelers to test, and the idea was following. So he and others in that group, or in the myxobacterial business, basically assume that there is no chemotaxis. and that these cells have a certain chemical which is produced during this aggregation process but stuck to the cell surface. The other thing is what they assume is that when these cells really come together, they exchange this information upon collision. I mean collision in the biological sense, not in So they touch each other, and if they touch in the direction of their own orientation, they can exchange this factor. This is transported into the bacterium, and this makes the cytoskeleton and everything change, and they move in a different way after this contact. And the idea is, which the model should test, was so these cells align. You see when you have this pattern, you basically see already all cells in one axis of motion, and in this case it would be this one. And then you have this kind of biological collisions and they back up and you see the cells doing weird paths, but the whole pattern is sort of periodic. And the question is, can you detect some information from that to see what, how does it work, basically?
Two questions. Yeah. What is the grayscale, black, white?
These are also cell density, so I mean, I'm not sure if the, let's assume that the black is the high cell density. So you, and they check on this.
And what's the difference between these two?
I mean, this is the aggregate. And you zoom basically on this area where you see this kind of rippling. And this is before the aggregation. Also, these parts are not in the aggregation stage, but these patterns you see for about 1 day before aggregation takes place. You can produce mutants which don't do it and still aggregate, and you can produce mutants which do it and show completely different wavelengths. You can mix these mutants and calculate the wavelengths of the patterns, and if you put in too much mutants, which usually don't do that, you lose the wave pattern. So you have a certain parameter control.
But the scale is the same on those.
Yeah, you're zooming on it. I mean, okay, I don't remember this, but I can check in paper, but roughly the same. I mean, you're looking on cell density.
What's the cell size?
Oh, they are about 1 micrometer in width and 8 in length.
How big is that?
So the typical ripples are, so this kind of crest would be about 4 cell lengths, and this should be larger, it looks pretty much the same, and here it's about 10, I would say, in length. That's what they say, but I can check the details on the biopair if you want. But roughly, yeah, yeah. No, sorry, I didn't put the... Yeah, that's how I tried to explain that. Mm-hmm.
Now, how do they actually move along this line? How do they move themselves?
As a biomechanically, you mean? Or
in what direction?
Oh, here they move in this direction.
And they move positively.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And then, after these condensation points.
Finally, yeah, after. Yeah. Yeah, and if you. Yeah.
Is there a movement continuous? Of course, they just keep on going.
No, what you see, I mean, they did measure single cell paths. I haven't have a photo, but I can show that to you. They measure cell paths. I mean, I can do that also or later, these details. And they measure what does a cell do when there is no background rippling. So then they typically, they measure somehow turning. So what is the time between two turns? And if there's no rippling in the background, you get basically such a kind of curve with a long tail. Okay, nothing special. But if there is ripple... So this is time, and they measure several cells, and they click exactly between two turns. So what's the average time between two turnings? And if that's with a homogeneous background, and if you have this rippling background, and figure out one, you mark, color mark one bacterium, then you see a curve with two peaks. Yeah. And this is about the wavelengths, and this is about half the wavelengths, but that's not clear. So what the cells do is they do this back and forth movement. I mean, once they are here, basically it's of course a 2D or 3D problem, but they build layers of cells, so it's really a 2D problem for a while. But then they are aligned. We start so far at the aligned stage, but we go into the 2D problem too. Then they are basically all oriented into one axis, which is perpendicular to these cell density waves, and then they back up. So if they meet somebody and exchange the signal, they just back up. And if there's a mutant, they don't do that. I mean, they don't get the signal, and then they just go ahead.
The reverse motion is generated
right
by everything, and then it
right
up, and then
yeah
back up.
Yeah, and it's an exchange of a signal.
So it's not a continuous traveling wave, it's a superimposed zigzag.
Right,
it looks like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You mean not the biomechanical movement, but the biomechanically, George Oster and people are looking for that, like slime nozzles which are pushed out, or they think there's a surface wave and stuff that these guys move because they don't have flagella. And otherwise, it's first a mechanical movement when they are single. So the question is, how do the bacteria biomechanically move? Yeah, people look at that. It's not completely clear. So it could be an undulating surface which adheres to the cell, or it could be a surface wave. People discuss that. But if you look at them not biomechanically but chemically, because they change the movement, is the exchange of the signal. It's just not diffusing. I mean, if they are under starvation, they produce that on the surface, and if they are colliding in the biological sense, in this case, with another cell, they get an information directly from that contact and not from a diffusive signal which comes around. Otherwise, it's a chemical signal, and they use it, take it in, and make the restructuring and whatever changes are necessary for movement. I don't look into the cell so far.
Like in the stadium, there are no pacemaker cells here. The aggregation can start on any cell, whichever is.
Yeah. I would even like to discuss that, because I suppose even with dictyostelium, it's like a stochastic perturbation, to my opinion. It might start on any cell, but I know there are discussions about that. I mean, some which start, which are, if you have a distribution of behavior, which are sort of at a certain end. But okay, no, here it's not, you don't specify them, you see it as a whole, but it doesn't mean they have analyzed it to all details. Okay. See where this goes. Okay, here you see mutants, not the rippling, but just to let you know how it looks if your population just spreads. So now you see again here just densities of cells, and here you see single cells in white. Yeah, these are typical myxobacteria.
So what have they done in these mutants?
Yeah, this is what I want to explain. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. You're the pacemaker for the talk. There are mutants, and they have two genes which basically control the wild type. That's what they think, and that's the A and S system, they call it. And one is called the adventurous gene system, and the other one the social one. This is the adventurous guy, so they knock off the social gene system. And the adventurous guy, usually they need a bit of contact, these myxobacteria in the wild type, to move. But this guy doesn't, so he doesn't have this so-called social system, so it just goes straight and doesn't care if he has contact. So that's why you see these guys going ahead, exploring the boundary. Here is this kind of social mutant, so you knock off the adventurous system. This guy can only move if there is contact with another cell, otherwise there's no way to move. And that means it looks more like the fluid spilled on the table, and this looks very much different. It's all the edge of a colony in both cases. They do a lot of more mutants, but these are very peculiar ones, where you see that there's a big difference, and where you might ask, is it still related in function? So you might say the wild type has both things on, and then you look at the two extremes. Can you judge some? I mean, do you get some insight from that? But this is only a side remark.
This is all speeded up.
Yeah. Sure. They move very slowly. They move. You don't see anything right. That's the big problem. You don't see anything in the directly. It's about 1 to 2 micrometers per minute they only move. So one has to be very careful. There might be very strong relations to how the agar is. I mean, this has really to be discussed.
Because this has taken place over hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, they are not very useful for pharmaceutical industry. So just to let you know, if you want to hop onto a flashy topic, that's probably not where you get money from. Okay, but nevertheless. Yeah. Okay. So let me introduce just a simple model. We are going on with more complicated ones, but I think it's better for this talk to introduce how we try to tackle these kind of problems. There's lots of things to do. So that's done with Fritjof Lutscher. The question was basically posed by Dale Kaiser, and several people looked at on it so far. And we looked for self-organization due to this local interaction, and his idea was really a question to the mathematician or to the modelers. Let's assume you have this alignment already. So we do models in 2D and so on, but I give you the 1D model. So you assume everything is aligned. That's of course an important process, how this comes about. And then these guys meet, so you have a hump of right moving and a hump of left moving cells, and look at this gray cell which moves to the right. It makes contact to one of the left moving cells, and then it will back up. That means it will go with these guys to the left. So now the idea was, if they are asking, is this mechanism really the one which makes the rippling, how do we have to pose it in a math model? To be completely, I mean, as general as we can be, not to impose anything about the mechanism. So we said, let's use these kind of turning rates, which depend on the density of the counter-migrating species, and how do you have to write it down without assuming anything, if this is the right mechanism. So you have the right moving cells with a certain speed, and the left moving cells, of course, with a negative of that speed, if the speed is an average speed is the same. And then you say, these guys which move to the right will collide with some which move to the left, and there might be other dependencies, which we will see later, if they are coming about or not. They will collide, and you have a certain turning rate, and they become the left moving ones. The same here, we have the left moving ones which will collide with a certain coming from the right, and then they will become also the right moving guys. So
I don't understand these symbols. What
sorry,
is this,
yeah.
Parenthesis?
So this is lambda. The rate depends on this. Depends
function,
on, yeah.
An unknown function lambda.
Right.
Where did the right become the left?
This is here. Sorry, what I missed here, there should be a. In the original, there's a plus. So this lambda is different from that one, but there's a reason I'll explain. Sorry, I didn't optimize that. So the lambda is a function of the u plus and the u minus. And so you're here with the right moving population. So these are the right moving ones which collide. And this collision, if they collide with somebody from the left moving ones, depends on a certain, there's a certain functional relationship. And the dependencies, the simple ones, sorry?
That's a loss term.
Right, and that's a loss term. And these dependency, I mean, the dependency, the crucial dependency is the counter migrating guys. There might be, but you can also cancel that out so far, a relationship to the total density or whatever, you don't know. So I don't want to assume anything, so I say that's what they say. There is a functional relationship, I don't know, and they have these density dependent terms. So here I changed this, so maybe I should have done that in a better way. Before you would say, so that's the loss term and that's reoccurring, and that's the loss reoccurs on the left moving, for the left moving guys, and the same here. So I should have used a lambda 1 here and a lambda 2 here, basically. Yeah, I mean, it's basically symmetric, and that's what I wrote down here. I say, if this is the turning rate for the right moving guys, then it's the same as if I would switch the dependencies here. Because intrinsically you have this symmetry. They don't know if they are left or right moving, but they check the density. Okay, and that's so far nothing assumed. I mean, we have to explore that. I'll try to explain that because I think that's a, I mean, I would like to emphasize that I think one should ask this kind of inverse questions in the modeling of these phenomena, and it's usually very difficult, so I do this very simple one.
Is there anything known about how cells attack when they hit another cell?
Yeah, so that's a bit more complicated. So because they don't have a real head and tail and they back up, you switch basically. They still say these guys have very long pili, which are about one cell length. And the question is what these do, but they might be for this kind of sticking together. It's not completely clear. What they claim right now is that they have these receptors on the surface that they produce under starvation condition on the cell surface, this so-called C factor. And with this, I mean, they take, I mean, the receptors basically take the one produced by the other. I'm not sure if I really believe it, because that means the production site must be at a different location. And the question is, why don't you detect your own C factor? Is that completely impossible? And this kind of things. This I really don't know. One has
to localize the poles.
Right, yeah, yeah. No, they are localized at the poles still. So there are lots of open things here. There is actually a nice survey book about Myxobacteria. I figure it out. It's probably from 94. There might be even a new one now. So what is the task? I don't claim that you can solve it completely, but what would you do in an ideal world? You try this in a question by the biologist, and you try to figure out, can this mechanism be responsible or not? And then you have to ask this kind of inverse question, if you can. Of course, that's very complicated. So what do you have to do? Can you find conditions for this turning rates, which reside in the observed patterns? And if you find classes, are they meaningful? Do they mean anything biological? So the method to get conditions on these turning rates is, that's just mathematical terms, you can forget about that if you are not familiar with them. You can first construct invariant domains, that means you will not come to see sort of aggregates. And then you calculate an instability condition, which means you will find a moving pattern. That's all. You will not know if it's a periodic pattern, but you find a moving pattern which will not result in an aggregate. So we did that. This you can do analytically. And then you get very typical growth conditions for the turning rates. And this is also just formula. I explain later what they mean. So if you do this kind of this, you can all do on paper with pen. You get a condition A, which is the instability condition, and you get a condition B on the turning rates, which is good for that you don't get aggregates. So that would mean if these are fulfilled for the lambda, and we have a look at that, what it means, because these are a bit counteracting. So if you want to fulfill that one, you have difficulties to fulfill that one and the other way around. So you get a reduced class of turning rates, which could be relevant. This is just formula so far. Because I just wanted to make a short remark how you do it. I try to explain that now, yeah. So I give you some borderline cases. So one borderline case is, if you are right, let's always assume you are right moving, is to just collide with the left moving one, so the very simple one. That's the one which exactly falls into the critical situation that you cannot fulfill both of them. If you slightly perturb that by another exponent or whatever, you easily run into the condition, to fulfill the condition. And another borderline case is that if you say, okay, you are right moving one, it's important for you to have the counter-migrating species to react with you. You can also use constant factors before, that doesn't change anything. But you can also normalize if you wish. That's another borderline case. It's the same thing. Then both of the conditions are usually zero, and these are exact critical conditions. So if these, for instance, these two would be right, these are very much related to the idea that you have a kind of exact head-to-head collision. Yeah. That's everything is perfectly aligned, and that always two guys meet, that would be a typical rate you would have to introduce. So what is it about? I mean, they say they do align, they align sort of perfectly, and then you see the waves. So first of all, I thought it might be nice with these conditions to get the rippling, but you don't. You are exactly out of that situation. So what does it mean? So first we simulated rates around that. So let's consider one which is close to that. So you use a factor which can be even an additive term which can be zero. You can put that to one or this to zero, and P and Q to one. Then you have one of the critical turning rates. If you put Q to zero and P to one, then you have the other critical one. And if you want to fulfill these conditions, which are sufficient, not necessary, but sufficient for this pattern you want to see, the rest we simulated, then you need basically that the Q is bigger than P and that the P is bigger than 1. So you cannot have just the simple turning rate. And the critical case was, in our case, that the P and Q is equal to 1 and the alpha and delta is 0, and that was our second borderline case. And now let me first show you the simulation and tell you what I think what it means. Let me explain that maybe first. Because you see these rippling patterns in the lab for a very long time, and they might not be important at all for the aggregation process, but they are there. You have very clean conditions. And the cleaner the whole thing is, I mean, for instance, they can produce a situation where they introduce something what we would call periodic boundary conditions. I mean, because we had this problem, what's happening at the boundary? They don't know, which I consider strange, but basically I have to take it. Because if you have a swarm and the bacteria run outside, at the at the end of the swarm, they have to have a different behavior because they don't meet other guys. So when they back up, it's a different mechanism for sure. But they can't say anything about it. So what they did, I don't know why, but okay, they couldn't answer that because I would have, instead of introducing boundary conditions, you would have had to introduce the mechanism to turn at the edge of the colony, which I cannot so far because there's no idea what they do. So they did an experiment, Welch and Kaiser, where they produced it like artificial periodic boundary conditions. Usually you see the waves. Is that okay? I don't need much. I can try to explain it by hands. But you don't see here. Okay, usually you have this, and you have this colony, and what they did, and you see the patterns going through here, they could make a kind of circular colony, where if you think about this circle, where the traveling wave patterns went through like this. So it was periodic. Yeah, it's a strange way to solve that problem, but they did it. I mean, you can produce colonies where the wave patterns move like this. So you have this plate, and they move like this. So you have some periodic boundary conditions, so they don't have to answer this question.
Your fundamental domain is the circumference, or
yeah, no, in the experiment now. I mean, I used periodic boundary conditions, yeah, but I basically had put the line. Yeah, it would be a circle, and you have these patterns move. And counter micro, I mean, in both ways. And if they do that, and if it's, I mean, then it's periodic in our terminology, then these wave patterns are even more stable. Okay, I don't know what it means, but just to let you know. Okay, now let's talk about this borderline case. I thought if you see these patterns and you can stabilize them by very clean conditions, what could they mean? Are they basically, you want finally an aggregate, are they basically the borderline case before aggregation is kind of the perfect alignment, something which does it, but every imperfection makes the aggregation, question mark, and that's what we try to explore. So we did these simulations. And we saw numerically, I must say, so we had these sufficient conditions analytically, that's all on paper, and that's numeric, so we haven't proved rigorously that these are periodic patterns. This we have just done by simulation. That we try to do, it's not so easy with these kind of systems. But what we saw, and I'll just show you the right moving, I have no film here, unfortunately. I show you the right moving cells, and you see these crests of densities of high density which move around with this kind of turning rates.
So you solve these equations here.
Numerically, yeah. And I used...
I mean, this is not a stochastic simulation where you use this as...
No, no, that's... I'll discuss that later. That's done by other people and... Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, that's of course an important...
This is a 2D simulation.
No, this is a 1D simulation and you see the... evolving in time. So you start with homogeneous, sorry, yeah, I didn't have put.
And the density.
And then these crests evolve, and you see them moving to the right and left. So analytically, so we proved that there is a pattern which is moving and will not aggregate, but we didn't prove mathematically, rigorously, that it's a periodic pattern. This is just simulation. Say just, and that's what we try to do now. There are complications with these systems. These are strongly nonlinear hyperbolic systems, and we have to use some very delicate techniques to be able to see that. So that this we are about to do.
So you're plotting U minus or U plus?
U plus, yeah.
U plus.
Yeah. I have also a preprint around with two.
And
I mean,
U minus, like,
yeah, it's doing the other. Yeah, that's just symmetric. Yeah. But that's numeric, so I mean, I don't know if on a long time scale what will happen. Okay, and then I choose the borderline case. Before we had Q bigger than P, which was shifting the parameter to one side of the critical case, and then we shifted it to the other side, away from this perfect one-to-one collision, and then what we saw was the numerical kind of aggregate, yeah. So we had this critical case, which is also very tough to simulate. You get a lot of errors. You are really in a very critical regime. If you shift a bit to one side, you get these patterns, these traveling patterns. If you shift to the other side, you get something which localizes. Yeah. So hypothesis so far, is this exact one-to-one collision really the borderline case, which makes the aggregate and before everything produces this kind of ripples as a pre-pattern, which is not the final goal, but if everything is very clean, which makes it go for a long time. Is this what's the reason? Yeah, that the perfect, I mean, as soon as you have the perfect alignment, you really are going to aggregate. So that's the claim. So let's do what we've done next. So of course we wanted to verify how far this model goes, and we used a Mutin experiment. And as I explained before, you have this wild type, you have this surface bound signal, and you have a mutant here, and this wild type, if colliding with this mutant, will produce the signal, and it will occur in the, I mean, it will be transferred into the mutant and will do something about its motion. Whatever it does, it's of course a biochemical pathway and a change of cytoskeleton structure and so on. But the wild type will not receive a signal by the mutant, and so it will just go on and the mutant will back up. And what De Keyser and co-workers do is they mix these guys in the population. So once again, the mutants do not produce the surface bound signal, they cannot initiate reorientation of other cells, and mutants can reorient when they get the signal from the wild type. So that's sort of our parameter change experiment. So what do they observe? So the wavelengths of the ripples increase with an increasing fraction of mutants. Mixtures where you have very few wild type cells included, they don't show rippling at all. But this you can put into the model. You just introduce your model with a wild type, U plus, U minus. You introduce M plus, M minus for the mutant, and write the same thing very abstractly down like before with four equations, and say only that the turning rates depend on the wild type only, on the U plus, U minus, and not on the M plus and M minus.
Remember your model, you have a terminal spontaneous change in the direction of it only due to a collision that they turn around.
No, there is also a random term which was hidden in the lambda. Yeah, and this seems to play a role. I mean, I'll discuss that maybe later. So that can be hidden in the lambda, an autonomous turning. And De Keyser is basically figuring out how high the autonomous turning, what he measures as autonomous turning has to be to get these patterns on when not. There seems to be a relationship, but we have to see. Mm. This is, I mean, yeah, okay, now that you're asked, this is exactly the critical case. Then suddenly these additive numbers, the numbers you add play a role. If you have this functional dependency and then you have just plus alpha, suddenly this plays a role, the relationship, the closer you are to the critical situation, then there's a strong...
The alpha is this
the spontaneous, yeah. They call it autonomous turning or so. Okay, but I think I should go into more details in a private discussion or afterwards. Okay, the turning rates depend then on the density of the counter-migrating wild-type set and maybe on the total population. That's still something one should discuss. So how many can meet? I mean, what is the law of collision here? Yeah, maybe we can also discuss that later. So how likely is it to collide? Is it just like particles in a gas, or is it, I mean, one has to be a bit careful about that. Okay, then we calculated the wavelength, and this is the percentage of, so that's 100% wild-type, and this is 0% wild-type. And we just see, I mean, that's just qualitatively. So here you increase the number of mutants and you increase the wavelengths. This is the wavelengths. But we still have to, that's also again numerically, so we have to explore that a bit. Okay, so far to the myxobacteria. And now I want to go back to Dictyostelium. So we know that a lot, and so you have seen all these films. That's a single Dictyostelium discoideum. And you see here a chemical coming from the pipette, and you see how it reacts to the chemical CAMP. Here you see a whole colony that's already a final aggregation state. So you see the streaming, that's very high cell densities. This movie will restart, and you see how this kind of aggregate develops from the beginning. So now we are not with elongated bacteria. We have really this motion with extension of pseudopods. That's not in bacteria the case. So that's still a discussion. How do these bacteria really move? They don't have flagella. So here we know a lot. And you also see maybe that there's a whole lot of restructuring in the cell taking place when it moves. So I'm not going into the situation now to model exactly. That's done by many people. And there are hundreds of models around. how this exactly happens and what patterns you finally get. These are aggregates. But what I want to focus on now let's go back to chemotaxis or chemosensitive movement. When we want to measure what a cell does, we can measure basically, so what is this path? Yeah, how fast does it go somewhere? How does it reorient? That can even be bacteria. Yeah, it doesn't have to be Dictyostelium. When you really have chemotaxis, or like in Escherichia coli, what do you have to do with so famous and classical Keller-Siegel model when you take these measurable parameters? There is a relation between them. How does it occur in your model you should use? What these guys are doing? So are they measuring these guys? Okay, one might know, but also different species which do chemotaxis. Are they checking on their receptors, the signal itself? Do they measure differences in the back and in the front? Do they measure time gradients? How does it affect the model you use? Yeah, so your way of measurement gives a certain macroscopic description which reflects that. And sometimes you don't see a difference, and this I would like to explain. So this is with the two Korean postdocs, Kang and Wang. And I try to explain that, so there will be some formulas, but I mean, don't worry about that one. I try to give them a name and a meaning. So the classical model of Keller-Siegel type is use the density of cells and use the concentration of the chemotractant. In that case, it's CAMP, but it could be any chemotractant. And in the 70s, the following model was set up, and even before mentioned by Patlak in 53. You give the dynamics of the cell density and the dynamics of the chemical. So you say there's a diffusion of the chemical, and you say there's a production and decay, which I will not specify. Forget about it at the moment about the mu and the chi, just for a minute. The way to set up microscopically or phenomenologically this flux of these cells is you say here you have diffusion, yeah? Forget about the mu for a while. You have diffusion. And here you have a kind of drift part, forget about the chi for a moment. So you have concentrations, high concentration of the Wee, you have gradients of the chemical, and you like to go there, yeah? Because the flux would be a plus, and then you would see exactly this term. That means first part is this kind of spread part, the second part is the one which makes it go to higher concentrations of the chemical. Okay. What the chemotactic sensitivity is, it might depend, they say there's a sensitivity, which so it could be a constant, it could depend on the chemical, it could depend on the U density. So just again, I write down it very generally and not to say anything before, and I want to see how does the exact, I mean the measurement of how you get information from the chemical around, how is it reflected in these terms? That's what we did. And I must say, to warn you, it's just a few slides. These two guys are from very pure math, partly from Navier-Stokes, so we did some kind of a very rigorous math on that, but I'll try to explain that in detail because they wanted to go into biomodeling and asked me basically why don't biologists like regularity theory. But I explained them to why they don't. Okay, the question is, how can the chemotactic sensitivity be interpreted in terms of these really biologically measurable parameters? Okay, don't worry about the formulas. If you write down a model where you say, okay, I have a cell, I have an average, this is all averaged already, I assume that averaging is possible. That's a big problem.
What?
You have the average cell density with a certain orientation. Yeah. So you say, let this U be the average cell density with a certain orientation nu. This first part reminds you very much of the hyperbolic system I've shown you before. So I see how these guys move in direction nu with a certain velocity. Yeah, I mean that's their orientation. So then you do the same kind of change, and don't think too much about the formulas. But what you say here is, okay, I have this guy, this average density of guys moving in this direction. Now I want, they get a signal, they measure it somehow, this measuring somehow is this guy, so you measure the signal, it will be gradients, later on I just write a V, but it will be time, space gradients, space differences, whatever you like, yeah? And they measure somehow the signal at the front, at the back, over the whole cell body, they measure with time, whatever, and then they decide to move. So they decide and they turn into another direction by evaluating the signal. And that's this term. It's completely abstract. So it says, that's the loss. And you will become a new guy. You will become a new prime guy. Yeah, you had your new orientation, new prime. And these are the guys who are somewhere else and like to move into this orientation because they measured something. And again, the V as before, had that's the same equation as before. You have diffusion and then you have a production decay term. And if you integrate over all orientations of the you have the total cell density. That's what you say here. This is our little U. And so don't worry about the how I wrote it, but that's what the model means. And it's completely general. It doesn't say anything so far. It only assumes that this chemical has a specific way of diffusing. And this just means I turn, I reorient you to a certain measurement of the chemical, and this will be hidden here. And I explain what you see if you emphasize on that one. It's a velocity, yeah.
U is the velocity.
U is the velocity, and it's 2D now.
Whatever, or 3D, that you like, yeah. Okay. So now we had a look, and now we wanted to know. So when the way I measure, this is will be hidden here. And the question is, what does it result in? And you can make a link, even rigorously, to the Keller-Siegel model, which might not be so important for you, but for these guys it was important. So you can do a rigorous parabolic limit. That just means you do it all on paper and with paper and pen, and you finally get this for the total cell density, and you get here only dependency on the chemical so far. The other thing is more complicated. And now I explain how these parameters will be related to each other. So you can take one, the model I showed before, and derive rigorously by a parabolic limit this kind of model. That means the first equation. And what we are interested in now is what does it mean for the chemotactic sensitivity? What is the chemotactic sensitivity? So for instance, you can do a whole lot, but I'll just give you two examples I thought, sort of some reasonable ones. You say, okay, let's assume you measure the chemical where you are, basically, and you measure a bit ahead. And these are like point particles. That's, of course, one should change that also. But at the moment, we are just averaging everything, assume that this is all right, which is the problem, of course, and say, what do you measure? You measure where you are, and you measure a bit ahead. What you get finally in this classical Keller-Siegel model is that the mu and the chi are very much related. The chi is namely the mu plus sort of this, I mean, you might use a functional, but I mean, we can choose a specific one if you want, times a certain factor which depends on this derivative of this function. It just means that the chi is related to the mu, yeah, multiplicatively. And this I can specify maybe more in a private discussion. It's not just anything. You can think about reasonable phis here and see what this makes. It's the derivative with respect to the second component at the place where you are. And this gets the meaning. It's kind of you check a bit. I mean, if you look at that more closely, you see if you have, it's exactly what they measure in experiments. If you have a chemical where you are and you measure ahead and the chemical is higher, that would mean you have a gradient. Then the derivative with respect to the second component would be positive. So the chi would be positive, which means in mass terms that you get aggregations that could be proven for the Keller-Siegel model. If this would be smaller than that one, this would be negative, and that would mean that you would turn. Yeah, this you can exactly translate that. That would be negative, and that would mean this chi would be just smaller or even negative itself, and that means you spread more, so you turn again. So what people measure in chemotaxic experiments is exactly this. If there is chemotaxis going on, they see that these guys keep on going if there is a gradient, and if this gradient is the wrong way around, so it's not a rising gradient, then they start to turn away. And this is exactly reflected in this calculation. But okay, otherwise it just relates the microparameters to the macroparameters. So now you can say, what is the chemotactic sensitivity really in measurable parameters? It's not just a term, but it's really a measurable quantity.
Because it's interesting. We have x, and then u is the value of the same value.
Sorry?
X plus epsilon.
It's also three-dimensional. So yeah, right. Yeah, sorry. I'm okay. Maybe I have to. I'm a mathematician, so just. Yeah. No. Sorry about that.
Thanks. I mean, it's relating micro to macro. You still have to know phi. That's micro.
Okay. No, that's true. That's true. We need, so the biologist, I mean, okay, needs to measure what is the, okay, no, that's true, that's true.
It and really, E is a constant? What is this?
Oh, this is the, this you can consider one, this is the average of the velocity, so just consider it one. You can do very strange mathematical.
Really this phi.
Forget it, yeah. It's just mu times second derivative of phi.
Well, right, but then there's also a phi in mu.
Right.
So. Okay, but that's new.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but if you take an example and where you say, okay, I make the phi like that, that it's really increasing, then you see exactly what they measure, I mean, qualitatively. Yeah. And then it fits in the sense that you say they reorientate more often or less, and you see chemotaxis or not. Because from the parabolic model, you know that with a large chi and a positive sign, you get aggregates. I mean, there's more to it. But in a simple way. Okay, but, and then I give you, and then I probably am close to. So let me now explain what people discuss. So the biologists, of course, discuss what do these guys measure and why we analyze that. Maybe I should have shown that before. So how do you measure basically the stimulus and what role does it play for the chemosensitive movement? So the far goal, which we haven't pursued so far, is can you distinguish, finally, if you know about the measurement, or if, I mean, even, I mean, okay, let me make a bit of a dream. If you really see a pattern, and you can judge that this comes from a specific way of measuring, maybe you could, I mean, if you could judge that this pattern occurs only if you measure the chemical this way or that way, then you can sort of check back on the functional mechanism. Because the macroscopic equations, they are very much different depending on what kind of measurements you do. So if you have two macroscopic equations and they would be different in pattern formation, which I don't know, they might not at all, then it's not important. But if they are, then you would, in the ideal situation, see different patterns and say, okay, these guys will definitely not measure along their path or whatever. I mean, it's a bit very vague, but this is why you look for that. So let me, yeah. So let's see what could be possible evaluations. So it could be a spatial one. You could evaluate at distinct locations. It could be temporal. You can measure two times and two times. And it could be positional, that you just check the chemical density where you are. And it could also be directional, when you have a certain orientation. You might be an elongated species. Then you check just this way on your path. And this gives different macroscopic equation, but that's all I can say if there is really a difference in pattern formation we haven't explored so far. So, and this is, don't worry, just to show it to you. So you can plug that in. You can say, okay, this guy measures a bit ahead, a bit to its back. It measures a different time. It measures space gradients. It measures even space gradients in the back. It measures time gradients ahead in the back. And whatever, and it just measures its orientation, and it measures even the angle from one, the shift from one orientation into the other. If you do that, you can write down a horrible formula for the parabolic model, and you get different types of Keller-Siegel models. So what you see then, for instance, is if this part doesn't explicitly depend on your orientation, and you have just this measurement of your changes of angle, then you don't see anything of that in the macroscopic equation, but that's also reasonable, because if you just everybody changes its orientation, it's like random changing the orientation, you wouldn't see anything on the density level, yeah? These guys would be there, but other guys would be where these guys have been, and macroscopically you don't see anything, though something has happened. Yeah, so these things reflect very nicely. And that means, if you look at that, you have different ways of evaluating the signal and you get completely different macroscopic equations. And let me finish with that one. So a typical one, just to see it, if you take what we had before measuring in the front and in the back, but also spatial gradients, then you don't not only get the Keller-Siegel model, which is this one, but you get an additional term, which is completely different from what has been analyzed so far. I don't want to say more because we haven't done the pattern analysis of that. We do something like, again, wave patterns and stuff on some of these models right now, also with Dirk Horstmann. So let me finish. So the goal of all this and also other things is, can you obtain suitable macroscopic descriptions? And if you obtain them, do they mean anything? If they are not different in pattern formation, then you have just lost a lot of time to explore that. If they do, then you are in the lucky situation that you can check, that you somehow get an idea what is the specific functional behavior. And now also to say, if you look at these models, you would also suggest to the biologists basically, do not distinguish between chemokinetic and chemotactic behavior and whatever what it is. They try very much to see if a population is doing chemotaxis or not, of just changing erratically to the chemical signal. If you look at that one, the suggestion would be that the basic mechanism is a reaction to the chemical and a reorientation, and it depends more or less on the strength and your way of measurement, what you see on the macroscopic level. So if you are not fast enough or strong enough in your returning, or you do it in a different way, you will have an effect, but this is not chemotaxis. You will just have a change of structure, but not the aggregates, but you have, will have something else. But the basic functional mechanism is sensing a chemical and changing orientation and speeding up or whatever, and that's what you do, and you do it in a different strength or in a different way. So in that sense, this basic functional mechanism would be reorientation due to chemical signals. That would the one be which I would call the basic functional principle, and then its way you measure will be of different type. And people have very much difficulty. Sometimes they say, we cannot decide, do they do chemotaxis or not? We see both, and they try very much to figure it out, but that's reasonable if you look at that. It's no wonder. I mean, I don't claim that I'm right here, but it's not a surprise. If you look at that model, that's clearly a shift of parameters, and you might be in a regime where you see both effects easily. There's no problem at all if you look at the problem this way. Okay, thank you very much for the attention.
Now you're doing pattern analysis for these various kinds of Keller-Siebel.
For reasonable ones, right. So what we are asking, for instance, in the context of wound healing, Hartmut Schwedlik in my group is doing that, but looking at wound healing only from the chemotaxis point of view, you have to include, of course, this cell matrix adhesion and stuff. He looks somehow which, again, in a kind of inverse way, which kind of sensitivity functionals give rise to these fronts which propagate together and which don't? How is the effect of this diffusive part and the one of the chemotactic part? What is the growth? If you have only little growth, does even chemotaxis enhance the growth, or do you need really the growth? And to distinguish the effects of all the different, on let's say, three different entities. Of course, what we are more interested in right now is to get to sort of answer this question, get this 2D alignment. Is it possible by cell contact to get to start with a 2D model which looks similar like the last ones I showed, so these kind of transport models in any dimension, and you have the contact, that means you have a surface pulse signal, so you have to introduce into the turning kernel the density itself, which is then very complicated, of course. It's more like it's a Boltzmann type, I mean a highly nonlinear Boltzmann type of equation. And can you get an alignment? Can you get by certain turning kernels, can you get really from a 2D situation to approximately a 1D line?
Now you're talking about simulation or
no, math. I mean, that's analysis if we can do it.
So I don't understand. What is the analysis? I mean, you're looking for certain types of solutions.
Yeah.
Steady states.
Yeah. Like with the travel. That's
stability analysis or what?
Like for front propagation, you look maybe in wood healing for a traveling wave. So you write down the abstract.
Certain classes. Certain of steady pattern. State solutions. Yeah. Exist.
Yeah.
And so you.
Like an inverse question, not to specify, I mean, of course, we cannot do that always rigorously, but as far as we can, we don't specify the nonlinearities and want to classify the ones which give rise to that pattern and the ones which give rise to the other pattern. And then
this is testing steady state patterns. So you turn PDE into ODEs and then analyze those, or how?
Yeah, in the traveling wave situation, yes. If you do this alignment thing, you do basically a moment expansion and show whether the you assume that this is the first or second is the strongest one, and show if this is sort of rising or falling, and analyze if you get sort of bundles, oriented bundles, in which direction this you can do by moment expansions. So you ask, do you get one oriented bundle, do you get two, which orientation do they have, depending on the kernel you have, or do you get four, what kind of specific...
Basically, you're testing steady-state solutions.
In the bundling, not necessarily, but you can do it. I mean, Edith Geigen has done it like a steady-state analysis, so in that sense, it's right the way. We are trying to do it dynamically, even, yeah. So that, the long-term behavior is this pattern. Yeah, maybe I misunderstood. No, but you can do, with this, so traveling waves is fine if you do a 1D, but you also have two, if you're in higher dimensions, it's not a ODE, so you still ask the same thing. You set up a kind of Hamiltonian and ask if you can have a wave in a certain direction, mu, which is not just one space. You can do the same traveling wave ansatz. Or you can say it's like a...
How do you answer the question? That's analytically...
Yeah, also with the traveling wave thing, Hartmut could do that, yeah, Hartmut Schrödlik. Not always, it's difficult. The most things we can't do, like here in this hyperbolic thing, we have to stop, but we try, of course we will not answer that completely analytically. The goal is to go as far as possible analytically and then know very well why we have to stop to do analysis so that we really go to the point where we say, okay, here techniques are missing, but we go, as far as we can. And with these, like here, these derivations are completely, that's really rigorous. Okay.
Yeah.
But with the myxobacteria, rigorously, we just know there is a moving pattern which will not result in aggregate, but the periodicity we haven't. This we try to show now with Heinrich Freistühler. I'm not sure if we can do it. It's always going hard at the borderlines of mathematical techniques. But we try to do that. You could be happy with the simulations, but if you look carefully at the code, you get with these borderline cases also into really numerical borderline cases, and that means you never know. I can be optimistic, which I'm basically, but if I'm completely hard, I say, okay, then I don't know, yeah? Because also the code has these problems. We are very careful, but you cannot answer that if it's periodic, so you have to do the analysis. That's the only reason, yeah.
Where are the receptors located on the surface of the cell
in the ictus stenum? In the ictus, I think overall the whole cell surface.
There's no localized to where.
They sometimes discuss that these can even be clustered, but I don't know too much details. I could let you know maybe people who might know about this, because I really don't know if they do it or if they have carefully measured that, if they can be moved to places.
Wouldn't I give you? Been playing devil's advocate slightly.
Yeah, of course.
Better to go from the biology and use the biology to determine what sort of model you've got, rather from the other direction, which is to write down all sorts of different equations, which is what I think you're doing. And then trying to
no, I think that. I try to combine both. Maybe it's not. You can answer that then. No, the reason is to combine both. Of course, if you know something specific how they measure, I'm happy. Then I wouldn't pursue this kind of way. But if people say. Let me take it. As long as people really say they try to figure out if a population is doing chemotaxis or not, and they see something which to me now is not so strange, it doesn't mean I'm right, yeah? It's not so strange, something where they cannot decide. That's perfectly, that thing what I did basically gives one possible explanation. Well, it doesn't mean that it's right. I don't claim I'm right here. But then if they measure more carefully, of course I would like to go back now, give this suggestion to them, and then they measure something more clearly to verify, of course. I don't want to stay in the dark with that. It's the same with the myxobacteria. Of course, you you should give another prediction of that model, which is maybe not measured, and then make them measure that or verify or not verify it. I mean, just to mention your first question, there are models around which do particle, stochastic particle simulations, also by Alex Mogilner and Markus Beer, he might be here.
I mean, how big are the numbers really when you come in regions with a low density? What much of a difference does it make?
Yeah, then the ripples are not there. So the questions I tackled here are in the high density regime, and these are about 100,000 of cells.
And when you observe the experiment, you see the ripples.
Yeah, it's high density. Yeah, it's high density. No, otherwise, of course, yeah. This, no, they're still high, but doesn't mean it's 6 or 10 or something. It's still hundreds of cells. But
so the ripple structure itself could have.
Of course. No, of course. But maybe let me try to explain. Of course, one can do a second model and use this kind of stochasticity and so on. If you would be sort of in an ideal world where you can sort of calculate everything you want, let's say, which we are not. And but then, of course, how to say? Of course, you can give a row of models and then say we don't know what is right. But what you finally want to do, and I don't claim we have done that. I mean, Kaiser has now, I mean, just to give a really concrete example, has now 3 or 4 models. And he says, I don't know anything now. I've posed the question, you have 4 different suggestions, and what do I get from it? Nothing. Either you try to clarify among the different models, so the other models, for instance, suggest a certain delay of reaction, which is necessary to get the waves. Simplified, they can explain that probably in more detail. And he says, okay, I know the same as I knew before. And what the goal is, I mean, if you want to do biomodeling also, at a certain point you have to give strong hypotheses with your models, which are sort of surprising. I don't say that I've done it, but that's the aim, otherwise why do modeling? And that means you have to judge on the models. I mean, you have to, if you introduce stochasticity, you have to decide if this play, I mean, one would say, okay, let's do a single particle simulation, take the same density. I have to decide if there's stochasticity, if this stochasticity in the high particle number still plays a role or not. So I did that in an abstract way. I mean, I did that, for instance, for the classical Keller-Siegel model. I took a stochastic model, particle interaction, which is not, maybe not close to the biology, but I tried to come as far as possible. And there I could calculate, for instance, rigorously that the stochasticity is lost with high particle numbers, and I give the estimates in terms of particle numbers. So you know basically when this density description, if the stochastic model is right, when this is correct and when it's definitely not correct. So that you know if you are about 5,000 particles, it's perfectly all right, you get a very low error. But if you are below, it's not right, under the assumption in that case that the particles have a certain range of interaction. The local one I couldn't do, for instance, but this is what one should do. That's completely tough, but that's how you can sort of judge on these models, and I think that should be done. I think it's also done in good physics models, but I'm not sure. There's more philosophy, sorry for that.
Go to